Hi, everybody. Today's Friday, 18th, 2025, and our friends, Ambassador Chas Freeman and Colonel Wilkerson, are back with us. Welcome back.
Good to be with you.
Ambassador, I want to start with what is happening between Houthis and Israel. And here is an article in the Times of Israel. They're talking about that Houthis are just somehow shutting down the Eilat port in Israel. And they're actually talking about the Ben Gurion airport as well. But when it comes to this port, the only port in the Red Sea that Israel has, and it seems that it's dealing with a lot of problems, economic problems, and the debt they have. We are not, somehow we are living in some sort of chaos in the case of Ukraine, with the case of Syria. As you know, the case of Syria is somehow getting worse. But when it comes to the case of Yemen, between Israel and Yemen, it seems that Yemenis are trying to inflict some sort of suffering that nobody has ever done to Israel.
Yes. Well, the port of Eilat has been essentially shut down, I think, for almost a year by Houthi attacks. They do occasionally strike Ben Gurion Airport, which is the only international airport in Israel, and that has to be shut down. The Houthis remain the only government. They are the de facto government of much of Yemen, even if we don't recognize them. They remain the only government that has actually taken concrete action under the Genocide Convention, which calls on countries to oppose genocide with positive actions. And so they have stuck it out. They withstood a $1 billion campaign by the US Navy to shut them down. That failed. Obviously, they mean what they say and carry out actions. The Israelis have attacked them, tried to destroy the port of Hodeidah in response to the shutdown of both Eilat and, of course, the Iranian shutdown earlier of both Haifa and Ashdod, the two ports on the Mediterranean. So I don't know if this is really new news, but the Houthis seem indomitable. They won't give up.
Larry, where does it come from, in your opinion, when it comes to Yemenis? And the case of, because when it comes to the military power, they're not that much dominant, but the way that they're behaving is somehow, it's so difficult to deal with them.
Well, as Chas Freeman, probably Ambassador Freeman would say, we've been watching them for a long time. And I've been watching them in particular for a long time, because we actually conducted one of our fast rope down exercises, the one that I know was successful, the only one I know that was successful, on a ship bound for Sana'a. And we intercepted 500 or 5,000, I forget what it was, but it was a large number of M16s, US M16s, modified, but basic M16s. And we were trying to find out to whom they were going and what we should do with them, because we had not, for the first time, and the reason we were successful, notified the flag and country of the ship before we fast roped down on the ship. And we found out that they were on consignment to the military of Yemen, and that we had put them on consignment to the military. The brouhaha between state and defense was quite ripe for a few days. But all to say that these were not going to the military, because when we tabbed it up at state, that would have been about 12 rifles for every soldier in the Yemeni military at that time. And so we knew where they were going. They were selling for about $750-$800 US on the black market in Yemen. That's Yemen. But the thing that impressed me the most over all this time that I've been monitoring it is how resilient these people are. They keep coming back. They keep coming back no matter what their own government does to them, no matter what the other sects do to them who don't like their particular form of religion. They keep coming back, and they keep more or less irritating and even winning some of the struggles they have, both internally and externally, like this one. And I've been stunned at their ability to differentiate between commercial ships in the Red Sea that are headed for Israel or were headed for Israel and others, because those are the ones they concentrated on. And they did some remarkable damage to those ships. And so that's one of the reasons why the Port of Eilat, as the ambassador said, it's been bankrupt for about a year, maybe a little longer than that. And the military facilities that Israel has just above it, both an airfield and training grounds, it only place really in that portion of the Israel domain, if you will, that they have this sort of thing, is shut down too, because they can't get supply because the supplies were coming through the port. So it's a real sore point with Israel right now, I'm sure, because its economic impact is quite significant.
Every Yemeni man has a rifle.
And a knife.
But they're very decent people. I remember a story told to me by the Chinese military attaché in Riyadh, and he had been the attaché in Sana'a. This is a long time ago. He drove a jeep out of the capital up in the mountains, and he was stopped by a bunch of Yemenis who demanded he get out of the car and turn it over to them. And he said, well, how do I get back to Sana'a? And they said, we'll call a taxi for you. And he said, but I don't have any money. And they said, well, here's some money for the taxi driver. And they drove off in his jeep. So there's a long history of banditry, but also courtesy from the bandits. And they're pretty tough people.
Nima, I was training foreign service members as well as U.S. service members in 1979 at Fort Benning, Georgia, officers. And we had two Yemeni there, one sergeant and one what would have been the equivalent of a private. And we had a major who was our liaison officer at Building 4 for the Yemeni participation. And he was a Yemeni major. And one day, one of the guys came into my office, Yemeni, and he says to me and my first sergeant, he says, I want out of here. I said, why do you want out of here? He says, I want to go back to my sheep. Now, he's saying this with a heavy accent, and Top and I are looking at each other like, what's going on here? He says, I want to go back to my sheep. Well, what do you mean you want to go back to your sheep? You're in the military. No, I was just pressed into the military. I was just made to become in the military. I've always thought of that because this guy was pretty resilient. I mean, he's a pretty tough guy. And he probably went back and joined the other side. He was no longer comfortable being with the government. Now, I did tell him, and my first sergeant echoed this with him, when you get back over to Building 4, that major, he's going to beat the hell out of you. He's going to just excoriate you right in front of everybody and God, which we knew happened. He said, I don't care. I don't care. I'm going back to my sheep.
Wow.
Tough guy.
Yeah. Really tough guy. Yeah. Ambassador, we know that the case of Syria is somehow getting out of the hand. I don't know if Turkey knows how to deal with it, if Israel knows how to deal with it, the United States. The United States, we had Marco Rubio talking about it, and it seems that even the United States doesn't know how to deal with it. Here is what Marco Rubio said.
Obviously, these are historic, long-time rivalries between different groups in the south, west of Syria, Bedouins, the Druze community, and it led to an unfortunate situation and a misunderstanding, it looks like, between the Israeli side and the Syrian side. So we've been engaged with them all morning long and all night long with both sides, and we think we're on our way towards a real de-escalation and then hopefully get back on track in helping Syria build a country and arriving at a situation there in the Middle East is far more stable. So in the next few hours, we hope to see some real progress to end what you've been seeing over the last couple hours.
It doesn't seem that the perception of what's going on in Syria is the same on the part of the United States and Israel. they have some sort of different interpretation of what's going on.
Sure, because the Israelis essentially have occupied this area. They have not so far claimed to annex it, which is the historic pattern of Israeli expansion. They have now graciously allowed the Syrian army to enter this part of Syria. So much for respect for sovereignty. They clearly are in charge there. The Syrian army will try to straighten out the dispute between the Druze and the Bedouin, or perhaps not the Bedouin, but extremist elements who are in fact part of the Syrian government coalition. But in the middle of all this, of course, Israel has been bombing Damascus.
Yeah.
It's clear that in doing so, it is not only sending a message to the Syrians that it intends to rule the skies and exercise de facto sovereignty in Syria, but it's also sending a message to Turkey that it is not going to concede control of Syria to Turkey. So this is a very complicated situation. But I don't know what whether the the Israelis typically demand absolute security for themselves, which means absolute insecurity for everybody else. And I don't know where Mr. Erdogan is on this. I guess the Turks are very upset by the Israeli bombing, but I haven't seen them do anything.
Larry, as Ambassador Chas Freeman was mentioned, it was somehow describing the situation in Syria, but your take in what's going on militarily, what Israel is trying to achieve by attacking Damascus, is that a sign, a political sign, or they're trying to achieve something in Damascus?
I think there are a number of things involved here, as the ambassador hinted at. And by the way, a friend of mine in Damascus texted me this morning that one of the IDF Air Force attacks was clearly aimed at assassinating the new leader of Syria. They missed, but she said it was clearly aimed at him. I stumbled onto a video of Ben Gavir with subscription, subtitles. He was speaking in Hebrew. And he was saying, and I suspect there's some truth to it, that the Druze leaders, the key leaders in the area, had promised Bibi and him that they would vote for him were the elections to be held and were they to be considered viable voters, which Ben Gavir said also that would be easy to accomplish. And so what Netanyahu is looking for in part is to garner some more votes. Simple as that. He's looking for votes from them. I also understand, again, from my friend in Damascus, that this has created a lot of tension amongst the Druze in the community, not the leaders, because they're not necessarily in favor of that, but their leaders are in order to win, whatever they can win from Israel. And I think there's also heard this morning Erdogan with some ragged translation, but he likes to talk these ways. He likes to say fierce things, but he rarely acts on them. But he was saying some pretty fierce things about what Israel is doing and cautioning them to stop. And then the last point I would make is this is Israel, as the ambassador hinted. This is Israel. They will take whatever you give them and 10% more. And they will keep on doing that until someone steps in and stops them. The emphasis this morning in the conversation I had again with another person in Damascus was that Israel is going to not be satisfied, and they back this up with two statements they played for me from members of the Knesset. I know they're nuts in the Knesset, but there are people who are just certifiably insane in the Knesset, but they back it up with translations of what these people were saying, that they want additional territory, and the person interviewing them asked, what are you talking about? And they said, we want Syria, we want Jordan, and ultimately we want Egypt.
This is a very interesting thing because the religious Zionists, in addition to replicating the Nazi genocide policies and trying to make Palestine free of Palestinians, also have developed a doctrine of Lebensraum, a search for greater space. And this is reflected in a map that's in the Knesset and a patch that's on some IDF soldiers, which shows Greater Israel extending from the Nile to the Euphrates. Apparently, the promise that God allegedly made to Abraham doesn't apply to the Muslim descendants of Abraham, but only to the Jewish descendants. But this search for a greater Israel that extends through pretty much all of West Asia and part of Northeast Africa is real.
Ambassador, do you feel
do you see anyone stopping them? Do you see anyone stopping them? I mean, I think that's a salient question.
There was a fascinating effort by, I think, the Gray Zone, Max Blumenthal Company, to interview members of the Republican Party about how they felt about settlers killing Americans, which they've been doing. And nobody would answer the question. Susan Collins of Maine responded, "I'm pro-Israel." So the level of hypocrisy, denial, and inaction, paralysis, if you will, is extraordinary.
Larry, in your opinion, why Turkey is not somehow able to communicate the difficulties that they're experiencing in Syria with the United States? Do they have any sort of leverage on the, I don't know, not leverage, some sort of mutual understanding with the United States, with the Trump administration to do something?
I don't think so. I don't think anyone in the world, Nima, has a mutual, quote unquote, understanding with the Trump administration. I think a lot of leaders are sitting out there shivering in their boots as to what might happen with this administration. Others are utterly perplexed, but going on like Putin, Xi Jinping, and others, but fearful because, as I've said again and again and again, you can look at what we are now, and if they have any intelligence on us that's worth a damn, they know that we are a paper tiger militarily, with one exception, our nuclear stockpile.
Right.
So anytime they think about us, they have to be really worried about what we will do should we be put in a position where, you know, whether they're triumphant or whatever, say Russia and Ukraine, what we will do in response. They have to be significantly concerned about that. And I think that's genuine concern. Now, the smaller countries like Brazil, you know, you've seen what Lula's done with regard to the latest brouhaha of the tariffs. As I was saying in the opening with you, I think 70% of the world now is doing business with China, not with America. Or if they're doing it with America, they're doing far less, sometimes 50% less with America than with China. This is shifting. The power is shifting. Economic and otherwise is shifting. And this empire is in trouble. Every aspect of national power, it's in trouble with. And who knows what we're going to do, what we're going to do to strike out, to do this or that. I mean, and we've got a clown and a circus around him in charge. It must just be utterly disquieting to world leaders, especially people like Sergei Lavrov and Wang Yi and their bosses. It just must be unnerving.
It's the most incompetent administration in our history. It's delusional, and it is basically leading us into national suicide in every sphere that it touches. So there is an interesting reaction building against this, and we haven't even felt the full impact of, or much of the impact of, the crazy tariff policy, which we're coming. But you see efforts to dislodge the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Mr. Powell, and you see reactions internationally, which are, you know, run for cover. Don't stick with the dollar. Well, the dollar is the main prop of American primacy globally. And if we lose that, which we could by our own self-mutilation, we're in real trouble. I don't know how many people in the United States have any sense of that. They do on Wall Street. They know it.
Yeah.
Here is a video, since you mentioned the situation between the United States and maybe we are comparing the United States with China and the way that they're trying to deal and make a deal with other countries, but the United States is somehow incapable of doing this. Here is what the CEO of Ford Motors says about the situation they're in.
I've ever seen 70% of all EVs in the world, electric vehicles, are made in China. They have far superior in-vehicle technology. Huawei and Xiaomi are in every car. They have facial
recognition.
Meaning
cell phone technology.
Yes, yes.
Connected to their cell phones.
Yes, you get in, you don't have to pair your phone. Automatically, your whole digital life comes, is mirrored in the car. You have an AI companion that you can talk to, ChatGPT equivalent in China, to your, all the automatic payment is already there. You can buy movie tickets. It has facial recognition, so it knows who's in which seat and which media you like.
Wait, why don't Ford cars have that? Would you need to deal with Apple or?
Yeah, because Google and Apple decided not to go in the car business. And even beyond that, their cost, their quality of their vehicles is far superior to what I see in the West. I mean, we are in a global competition with China, and it's not just EVs. And if we lose this, we do not have a future of Ford.
He's so old. Yeah, go ahead, Ambassador.
He drives a Xiaomi car in Detroit, which just makes him a brave man.
Yes.
But we're certainly honest. But we're seeing this in more and more areas of technology that the Chinese are pulling ahead. And so the irony is, I can recall when I served in Beijing, I was the DCM or the Deputy Chief of Mission or the Chargé back at the beginning of the 80s. I made an argument which went totally flat to people in the State Department that science officers, instead of just doing show and tell about American technology and science, should be collecting intelligence on foreign science and technology because it was moving ahead. At that time, I was concerned particularly about the development of ceramics in Japan, which turned out to be the basis of a lot of the stealth technology that we have adopted. The basic point is the balance of power in science and technology is shifting rapidly away from the United States. And we are exacerbating the problem,
yes,
first of all, by cutting research and development money, by attacking our universities, rescinding grants, by demanding political control of university curricula, and by basically chasing after the best brains in the United States, making their professional lives impossible. And in the case of the Chinese, doing a lot of heavy breathing down their necks, leading to a brain drain. If you wanted to come up with a policy that was self-destructive, you couldn't do any better than what we've done.
I agree 100%. You remember I was telling you about John Maynard Keynes and the political consequences of the peace and how he describes in the opening pages what Germany was doing to Britain and France and why we actually got into World War I. We had to stop Germany. We had Britain and France had to stop Germany. Otherwise, they were going to be swamped and their empires ended. Well, what's happening today with respect to the United States and China? The very same thing. We're going to be swamped. So what are we going to do? World War III?
You're muted.
Ambassador, here is what Maria Zakharova yesterday said in response to what's going on in Europe. Here, she said that Moscow considers itself entitled to use weapons against military targets of countries that allow Ukraine to strike deep into Russia with their weapons, literally saying that those countries were giving the weapons to Ukraine to attack us, we're going to attack them. Why is Russia so much concerned about what's going on in Europe?
Well, I think this is a deterrent action, basically, cautionary. You earlier heard that they had made a similar statement to Germany about the Taurus missile, which is a long-range strike cruise missile, basically. And I note that the Germans have responded by saying they're not going to provide the Taurus to the Ukrainians. We have heard also of a crazy conversation between President Trump and President Putin, President Zelensky, in which he asked him if he could strike Moscow if we gave him the weapons, and almost encouraging him. And of course, you have to recognize that the current U.S., Russian, and Ukrainian relationship is entirely bereft of any diplomatic component at the moment. There are no peace talks. There's no peace plan. There is no plan on the part of the Ukrainians to talk, apparently. They continue to refuse. And yet we're pummeling the Russians for not being willing to talk. The Russians have always been willing to talk. So we're continuing the idiocy of the Biden administration in new form, in my view. And here I would also add that it doesn't help if you approach a serious issue like the issue posed by Ukraine, European security architecture, the issue of Ukrainian relationship to the rest of Europe, the question of the rights of minorities in Ukraine, in the way that we have. We have Stephen Witkoff going in to see Vladimir Putin, unaccompanied by anybody, no note taker, no interpreter, nothing. So there's no American record of what's said. We have General Kellogg doing sort of the same thing in both Kyiv and Minsk. And we have Donald Trump not agreeing with either of them in terms of what they say. So if you're Russian or Ukrainian, you're perplexed. I think Larry used that word. That is a mild statement. You're very confused about where things might go. And I think quite fearful because of the demonstrated wobbliness, erratic behavior, impetuousness of American decision making. And the Russians do have intelligence on the fact that there is no orderly policy process in Washington anymore. In fact, there is, and from my knowledge, Larry will correct me, but I don't believe there's a single Russia expert on Russia in the NSC now, even though we are engaged in very perilous interactions with the Russians. We've just cut the group at the State Department that were dealing with China. While we claim they're the pacing threat, to use the Defense Department's language. There doesn't seem to be any strategy or even any grip of tactics here. How can you deal with us, even if you want to?
And at the same time that this is going on, Nima, we have what you might call clandestine operations, I guess would be the best terms, going on in Azerbaijan, in Georgia. We have some really dicey operations going on with Ukrainian participation in a very delicate region for the Russians up on the Baltic Sea, in a little enclave they have up there. And we have some machinations going on the rim of the Arctic to try and influence what the Russians are doing and now what the Chinese are doing, because the Chinese are trying to get interested in the Arctic, or are interested in the Arctic, and trying to carve some kind of way to manifest that interest. And we are antagonistic to both of those efforts. So we are setting up this opposition, if you will. I call it an arc of crisis, all the way from the Arctic to the southern end of the Persian Gulf.
in the middle of all this, just to add one other item, we're threatening Kaliningrad.
Yeah. And I don't even know if Trump knows anything about this. I really don't. I
doubt he knows where Kaliningrad is or has ever heard of it.
He can pronounce it.
Pardon me?
If he can pronounce it.
Well, maybe. Yeah.
Meanwhile, he's got problems with his legs.
And that's not the only part of his anatomy that's in trouble. I just saw, Elon Musk is not famous for his humor, but he just posted something on X, which is how to make a totally invisible plane. And the plane is covered with the Epstein files.
That ain't going away either.
Oh, unfortunately, it is not. Anyway.
Ambassador, what you mentioned, I think, is a very important point, that there was a conference in Wiesbaden in Germany. And in this conference, General Christopher Donahue, he was talking about the Kaliningrad in Russia. He said that it's roughly 47 miles wide and surrounded by NATO on all sides. And the army and its allies now have the capability to take that down from the ground and in a time frame that is unheard and faster than we've ever been able to do. And you, when Russians are looking at the way he's talking about Kaliningrad and just sitting, what comes to their mind? It's somehow so much frightening when you see someone, when you hear someone talking this way. Is there any sort of responsibility for these sort of talks and these people are doing?
Before you answer, let me just say that the Ukrainians are in there advising that group.
Yep, that's right. And that, of course, is a very irresponsible statement, very provocative, very unhelpful. But it's part of a larger mentality which aims at dismembering the Russian Federation and countering it not only on its borders, but internally. So if you look at this issue, I think objectively, you'd have to say that the American posture is quite aggressive. I don't see a comparable level of aggression from the Russians, although they're certainly involved in a nasty war in Ukraine. But I don't see them trying to break up other countries. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But in any event, it's clear that we're trying to do that.
Colonel, in your opinion, is that of concern for Russia when they see a military general because he was talking about the eastern flank of NATO, that deterrence and the eastern flank of NATO, and how capable is that? Does he need to talk about these things, or he needs to somehow show how powerful he thinks, how powerful he would act?
You're talking about the Russian or the U.S.?
No, but I'm talking about General Christopher Donahue at the conference.
I don't know where they find these people, Nima. I really don't. They're bringing them out and brushing them off and sending them out to be envoys or whatever. This is really destabilizing in the sense that, as we were talking about earlier, the Russians have no idea how to figure us. They have no idea what we're going to do next or where we're going to do it. And that's okay if you're strictly operating on a military basis to keep your enemy unnerved and off balance. But we're not operating just on a military basis. We're operating as the empire. We're operating on every echelon of power and doing so inexpertly, insanely, and stupidly. So that adds to their concern, as I said before. It deepens, makes more profound their concern about what we're going to do next. So how do you counter that if you're a sane state and you're dealing with what you're dealing with? How do you counter that? You have to be on the qui vive everywhere you are, all along the flank of NATO, as it were, and elsewhere too, because we're messing around in other places too, like the South China Sea again. This big exercise that's coming up with Tonga participating and Vanuatu and all this massive military might that's going to be out there in the Pacific is a perfect example of it. What do the Chinese think? Do they want Papua New Guinea to be the major formidable enemy that's confronting them? I mean, what are we doing? That's my question. What are we doing? And who's in charge? Is this guy Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs? Has he a clue? What are we doing? And where we're doing it and how we're doing it seems to me to be utterly stupid. And yet, you know, and I don't think Trump knows anything about what I just said. I don't think he knows anything about it. I don't think Seth knows anything about it either, which is even more concerning.
There's no policy discipline because there's no coherent policy. So you have the same sort of statements coming out of Pearl Harbor, Honolulu, with the Pacific Indo-Pacific Command, very provocative. I think Larry, you're right. Suppose the Chinese ran a big exercise in the Caribbean Basin. What would we think?
Yeah.
You know. This is very provocative, and if we want to have a decent relationship with people, we have to respect their sensitivities, but we don't at all.
Larry, there is a military pact between the United Kingdom and Germany, and in this pact, they're considering Russia as a strategic threat to them.
Isn't that an interesting development? Are we back in 1914, 1913?
Mm-hmm.
I saw that and I said, oh, Starmer, you fool. Oh, Merz, you fool.
You know, it seems to me like the way they were talking about the Israeli attack on Iran was a preemptive attack.
What was the attack? What was the 12-day beautiful war really, Nima? What was it? It was a display of arrogance on the part of Netanyahu that, and this is really saying something because he's one of the most arrogant hackers on the face of the earth, that was in the face of a very calm, very prudent, very calculated, very well orchestrated campaign on the part of Iran that simply cowed him, I'm sure. I just know he was so surprised that he had to check his six a couple of times. They devastated Israel. And they could have gone on devastating Israel because they were running out of ammo and we were running out of ammo to give them. So when we resume this, let's see how it gets resumed. Let's see just what happens. I predict Israel will disappear.
There's it's one remarkable thing is the extent to which Israeli military censorship has been able to conceal the damage in Israel. Of course, they have a pro-Israeli foreign press, which they subject to censorship, and which respects that. There are some alternative media outlets that have, in fact, reported on the five military bases, Weizmann Institute, the closure of Haifa, Ashdod, and the residential damage claims, the property claim damage claims, the number of people wounded and injured and so forth. There's no reporting at all in the mainstream media. It's all pro-Israeli, and I see articles which I think completely misjudge what happened in this exchange. I suppose the Israeli military, who are very smart, capable people, do understand how this came out and are appropriately chastened. But that does not appear to be the case with Netanyahu. And that's certainly not the case with our politicians.
If you look at the IDF's reports on the cases of post-traumatic stress disorder that they have right now, it's really serious. And if you look at what is just short of that, which is psychological trauma and such that's reported and results most often in either a short stay from the battlefield, absence from the battlefield, or a longer one, up to 30 days, you're seeing a third of the IDF being severely impacted by what they're doing in Gaza and the West Bank. And increasingly, it's becoming what they're doing in the West Bank that's producing these cases. So that they've got some serious problems that Netanyahu just seems to be totally ignoring. And the people he now has in place in the leadership of the IDF, mostly sycophants, mostly people who adhere to his cause and such, they're not concerned about it either. So what are you doing? You're destroying the infantry units, as it were, and the armored units in the IDF.
There's been a very precipitate rise in suicides.
Yes.
Among the Israeli military, which just illustrates your point. The stress on that society is extreme. The level of vitriol they come out with, the statements that they, the genocidal statements and expansionist statements that come out of Israeli politicians, whether Larry, you're right, or they're clinically insane or not, is quite alarming and incredibly damaging to the long-term prospects for the survival of the state of Israel. Because I think we've just seen the first real meetings, one in the Caribbean, one in Bogota, of various countries that have decided to sever all relationships with Israel and basically support the International Court of Justice and the Criminal Court in the punishment of those responsible for genocide and other crimes against humanity. So internationally, you're beginning to see a reaction that has some consequences. And I believe in the United States, we're beginning to see that too. So time is against the Israelis, and I agree. Netanyahu seems far more concerned about saving himself from jail than he does about what he's doing to his own country.
Just to ramify that a little bit, I think that tape of Reed Rubenstein, Marco Rubio's lawyer, essentially threatening the ICC before the UN or before the ICC's governing body, the Assembly of States, I think it's called. It's just disgraceful, utterly disgraceful.
Well, it makes us into an outlaw.
Yeah.
And soon
the world's going to declare us that.
Yeah, well, I'm surprised they haven't already, actually. I think we're very fortunate that the UN has held together where we have a veto. But there's no reason that other countries cannot convene ad hoc conferences and make rules. We've just seen the BRICS fail to do that, frankly, in Rio de Janeiro. A very poor performance, I think. A lot of whining and complaining and no real action. But I think action is coming, and we're not going to like it.
Here is, Colonel Larry, here is what we've learned from the Ukrainian side. We know that the chief of the British General Staff, Radikin, he went to Ukraine. He talked with Sersky. And here is what Sersky said: the operational situation at the front and the critical needs of the defense forces of Ukraine are on the agenda. It seems that the British are trying to provide Ukraine with weapons, but how capable are they in doing that?
The only thing, Nima, that anyone could provide Ukraine with that would be a positive, a benefit, and might give them another day or two, is manpower.
Yep.
And no one's going to do that. If they do that, it's a whole different dimension. It's a whole different war.
Well, the French toyed with that, but sensibly pulled back. You look at the front, and you see a Russian advance now in every part of it, grinding forward. Also, I think, belying the portrayal in the press, you see exchanges of the dead, the corpses. 1,000 Ukrainians are returned by the Russians. 19 Russians are returned by the Ukrainians.
Yeah,
which tells you something about who's on the advance and who isn't, and also about what casualties are occurring. We see totally preposterous statements about Russian casualties and nothing about Ukrainian casualties from the press, which just seems to accept Ukrainian propaganda as the truth. And I don't think, you know, there are actually efforts being made by some organizations to account for battlefield deaths and wounds, wounding, but they're ignored in the press. The narrative counts for everything and can't be contradicted. And you start making policy on the basis of your own narrative, you're in real trouble.
Here is what, Larry, do you want to add something before?
No, I was just going to say, one of the stunning things to me, and it shouldn't be because I had to suffer through it when I was in government, but it's orders of magnitude worse now, is the irresponsibility of the mainstream media in America.
I first experienced this in the Gulf War when I was in Riyadh. There were 1,600 foreign journalists there to cover the war. Two of them spoke Arabic. I was told not to brief any of them, but I did brief 720 of them. And each briefing opened with a statement, if I ever see my name in print or you refer to me in any way, you'll never see me again. So there's nothing you can do for me except get me in trouble. But I have to say, the reporting was appallingly bad. And CENTCOM, General Schwarzkopf and company, had briefings which were extremely informative. But the military illiteracy of the press corps meant that they didn't pick up anything that was being said. It was really shocking. This was the generation that skipped Vietnam, you know, so they didn't understand what was being said. And I think it's gotten vastly worse. Because on the other side, the level of slick PR maneuver has gone up, and the blatant lies are now thick as flies in these government briefings. I mean, think back to the Biden administration and the man that Matthew Miller, who was known as, you know, he was unbelievable. Smirkula, he was called.
Yeah. I wanted to smack him every time I saw him.
Well, but I mean, it hasn't gotten any better.
And I got to say, the admiral at the Pentagon wasn't a whole lot better. He was a little smoother, but he wasn't a whole lot better.
I agree. Well, we shouldn't make policy on the basis of our own delusions. And
many people are interested that who's paying the Trump administration for these weapons that he was talking about in his meeting with Rutte. Here is what he said in terms of who's paying for that.
From what countries?
Coming in from Germany and then replaced by Germany, and in all cases, the United States gets paid back in full.
Have you started?
What's happening, as you know, is the European Union, if you look, mostly European Unions, but let's put it in the form of NATO. It's very similar. But NATO is going to pay us back for everything. In some cases, we're going to be paid back by countries of the European Union.
Yeah, NATO is going to pay.
No, he's saying that basically they're going to buy American weapons for transfer to Ukraine. That they're going to pay for those weapons. But there's bad news because the weapons production lines are not there. So, for example, this business of Patriots for Ukraine, we've just told the Swiss that their order of Patriots is going to be indefinitely delayed. There's a limited supply, and you can't do anything about that. And the basic point is the one Larry made, which is all these weapons have been in the possession of the Ukrainians for some time, and they've been used, and they haven't been able to stop the Russian advance. And they don't cure the manpower problem, which is the central problem for the Ukrainians. Ukrainians have been very ingenious. They've been very brave. They've been really quite admirable in terms of their military learning curve. But in the end, you run out of people. You know, we were going to fight to the last Ukrainian, but the last Ukrainian is in sight.
Yep.
Larry, we know that France is not going to pay for these weapons. I don't see Hungary, Slovakia, but is it all about the United Kingdom and Germany? Is it all about? It seems that Germany under the Merz administration is getting worse. There somehow is getting. We have to get back and find, go after Olaf Scholz and find him and come back to power. It was much better than Merz and the way that he's trying to somehow deal with the issue of Ukraine.
Well, if Merz wants his coalition to collapse even faster underneath him, go ahead. And I don't know how England, I won't say Great Britain, but I don't know how England is surviving with Starmer. I don't understand how he can survive. There should have been a vote of no confidence in him, and he kicked out a long time ago. But those two leaders, and Macron too, they're not long for the world. They're not long for the world. They'll be gone in 6 months. I can almost assure you they'll be gone in 6 months.
And NATO are not coterminous. I don't think the Irish are going to buy any weapons for Ukraine.
No.
And I think the real question here, however, is, and the French objection is well-founded, and some of the same reactions come from Italy, which is a major manufacturer of weapon systems. On the one hand, you're asking countries in Europe to beef up their own defenses. Part of that is beefing up their military industrial base. And on the other hand, you're saying you got to remain dependent on the United States, and we've got to increase our weapons sales, and that's good for Lockheed Martin and RTX and so forth and so on. But there's a contradiction here. And Germany, I think this is a problem in Germany too. Germany has been on the course to greater self-reliance. This is not consistent with that. And of course, the other part of this is that the German rearmament is not regarded with universal favor elsewhere in Europe, because they have a memory of what German rearmament can result in. So Merz had a grandfather who was a Nazi, and people are referring to that. So anyway, I think this is a story that is not yet written, and we'll see what happens.
And that's one thing, Nima, that makes me really ponder the relationship just announced between Berlin and London, the defense treaty or whatever.
Yeah, they call it military pact.
Yeah, shades of the past.
Yeah.
Ambassador, when Germany is asking for Tomahawk and Typhoon, these are long-range missiles. And who's the target of these missiles? I don't see Germany doing these attacks. I see in the worst case scenario would be they're going to send it to Ukraine attack Russia. But nothing good going to come out of this sort of transferring of long-range missiles to Germany.
Well, earlier you referred to Ms. Zakharova, the Russian foreign ministry spokesperson, warning against the transfer of such weapons to Ukraine. I doubt they'll be transferred to Ukraine. I think they reflect what I consider to be an overwrought, almost panicky sense among Europeans about the Russian threat. This, by the way, is fully reciprocated by the Russians. So the Russians, have a history of getting invaded by Germany, by France, by the Mongols, by the Poles, by the Swedes, by, you know, and they have every reason to be concerned about the direction of events. The Germans have waffled over the years. Sometimes they realize that you can't have stability and peace in Europe without an organic relationship between Berlin and Moscow. And sometimes they want confrontation, and they fear it. So we've seen the relationship between those two countries includes things like the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, as well as the current situation where the German government, at least, is very anti-Russian. So this is a very murky situation.
I think it's Willy Brandt's son, too, that's making some headway politically now with the kind of policies that his father had with regard to the East and with regard to Russia in particular. Tomahawk, Nima, would be a particularly destabilizing weapon to give them because it has a nuclear variant. So when you fire Tomahawk, you don't know whether it's got a conventional warhead on it or a nuclear warhead.
Sharing with the Germans, among others, what would be on those Tomahawks? And what would be the relationship to Kaliningrad, which I seem to recall was once German, actually. A lot of imponderables.
Yeah.
And no skill in handling them evident in Washington.
Here is what White House said about the 50 days that Trump's deadline for Russia to seek ceasefire between the two parties, the Russia and Ukraine. Here is what White House said.
The president clearly laid out if there is not a ceasefire agreement or a peace deal within that time frame, if Russia refuses to legitimately agree to a ceasefire, then they will face very steep tariffs and they will also face secondary sanctions. So countries that are purchasing oil from Russia will be sanctioned as well. And of course, that will do deep damage to Russia's economy. And I would just add that the president wants this war to end with a diplomatic solution. He's been pushing for it. This administration has spent many hours and a lot of time trying to solve this war very far.
Could have fooled me that they've spent many hours and much time.
No, so here's the charitable interpretation of that is that when President Trump talked to President Putin, President Putin is reported in some circles to have told him that he was going to step up the offensive for 60 days and take all of the Donbas Oblast that he has nominally annexed. I mean, he has Luhansk entirely under his control. He's taking a lot more territory in Donetsk and Zaporizhia. I think the charitable explanation is that the 50 days coincide with the 60 days. Mm-hmm. And that Mr. Trump has basically told him, you take what you can get over the next 50 days and then we'll revisit the issue. But the proposed solution or the threat is the United States declaring economic war on the world. And that is not going to work. And this is a Lindsey Graham idea, which ought to immediately make it suspect. Here we are. We're going to do secondary sanctions. I remember, because I'm a certified fossil, when I entered the Foreign Service, we were deeply opposed to any kind of secondary sanctions. We were protecting Israel from them. And we claimed they were a violation of international law. And now they've become the tool of choice for a foreign policy that basically is bullying rather than persuasive.
And in that regard, Lindsey Graham's remarks on the floor of the Senate were just abominable. I mean, not only demonstrating his utter stupidity, but also inviting the rest of the world to say, be gone, out of our face. Right. We want you no more. And you were the spokesman for that? Oh, God, Lindsay, go back to South Carolina and bury your head in the dirt.
Ambassador Maria Zakharova, yesterday, she also mentioned that Ukraine is avoiding any sort of talks for the next round of negotiations between Russia and Ukraine. How is that going to work for the United States, for the Trump administration? On one side, putting a lot of pressure. I don't know if a lot of pressure, but as you mentioned, that could be some sort of idea on the part of Donald Trump. But he wants to get something out of Ukraine. And on the other hand, the Ukrainian government is not trying to negotiate to talk with the Russian part. So is there any sort of force on the Zelensky administration to go in that direction?
I think what Ms. Zakharova said, or more or less meant, was that the aggressive stance that the Trump administration has now taken in terms of supplying additional weapons to Ukraine basically leaves Ukraine under no pressure to go to discuss peace. And that's over. And I don't think that's an unrealistic interpretation of the situation.
Nima, let me just say that the people I dealt with in 2002 and 2003 and a little bit in 2004 in Kyiv would by now, and I'm in no way meaning this as a compliment to them, but would by now have formed a group to get rid of Zelensky by whatever methods necessary. And that group would have had a positive side group with it that would have been the peace negotiating team that was going to approach Russia and really look for peace, however they could achieve it. Willing from the very beginning probably to give Russia most of what it wants. I can't believe that that hasn't happened, because the people I saw during that time frame, they might have been the biggest crooks I've ever run into in my life, but they were prudent, practical people in terms of their criminality. They would never have pushed Ukraine to this point of almost national suicide. Where are these people? Did Zelensky succeed? Did we succeed? Did MI6 succeed and all the rest of the people, CIA, Mossad, in eliminating them? Where are they? It's time they acted.
Yeah. I think nobody's talking. We talk about Gazans, Palestinians, but there are many people in Ukraine. They're not agreeing with what's going on in Ukraine, but they don't have a voice. They don't have
that. Never bothered them in the past. They had mafia. Also, that's the best thing to call it. I mean, even Yulia Tymoshenko, whom I thought was a breath of fresh air, she was one of the biggest crooks of them all.
Yep.
Cornered the telecommunications market and used it to reap money for her kin and family.
Before wrapping up, Ambassador, do you believe that we are today, as you see the United States, comparing to the way that China is behaving, China is dealing with the global majority, or is part of global majority and dealing with them, and the way that the United States is dealing with them. Do you feel that the United States under the Trump administration is heading toward a better position, toward a better, seeking a better situation for the United States, finding some sort of stability in terms of the, because the main goal of this administration, as I perceive it, is the economy of the United States. How is that going to work? How is that, considering all these weapons that Trump is selling to Europeans, to all over the world, I don't know. How is that going to help the economy of the United States, the stability of the United States?
Well, those are really two very different questions. On the economic policy front, the administration is frankly lunatic. It has no understanding of basic economics. Our trade policy begins with a repudiation of the law of comparative advantage, which David Ricardo proved in the 1820s. Adam Smith is no more. So I think the economic policies are essentially ruinous, and we will find that out. The other issue, however, is soft power. Joe Nye's way of summing up the propensity of others to trust and agree with you, which is a great advantage in trying to exercise influence or develop a following. We are busily alienating the entire world, even our closest allies. And look at Japan. For the first time in my memory, the Japanese are questioning whether they want American bases on their. So I'm talking about the Japanese elite, the government, is openly debating the question of the American presence and the attachment to the United States. We have, you know, we've taken a position on defense spending in Japan that is politically infeasible. But, you know, beyond that, we're basically trying to cut off all their auto exports to the United States. And we're imposing things on them. We're not consulting. And for a country that I know the Japanese are different from the Chinese, but they both have a strong concept of face, which is the self-respect you derive from the respect of others. And we're behaving disrespectfully, and they're saying so. So our relationship with Japan, which has been in many ways the least questioning, most reliable ally we've had, they don't ask when an aircraft takes off from a base on their territory what it's loaded with or where it's going. Really remarkable. We are calling all of that into question. The same thing is true in South Korea for different reasons. But, you know, I think we are, these are allies. These are countries that we have a commitment to protect and who have increasingly recognized that they have a responsibility to help us in whatever way they can, and we're turning them off. So the Chinese, meanwhile, you know, are pursuing their own interests with the usual intelligence and ruthlessness that they do. They make mistakes, but by and large, they demonstrate the kind of behavior that that builds influence and causes other countries to want to be associated with you, even as we're doing the opposite.
Let me just add to that and tell you that the New Zealanders have given up on us entirely, and the Australians, had they not the government they have right now,
yep, would be
exactly the same. Exactly. They are my friends in Australia are essentially beside themselves on what to do. They don't know what to do. This submarine deal alone has driven some of them up a wall. They know it'll never come to fruition. They know that if it were to even come three quarters to fruition, they would spend a lot more than it's worth and never get the technology we promised. We're just ruining. We're peeing in our own bed, Nima.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Ambassador and Carl, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Thank you for putting up with such depressing comments.
Yes.
Exactly.
Someone told me the other day I have to quit going on because I'm making them too depressed.
There's not a lot of joyous stuff going on in the world at the moment.
It surely isn't.
No, at all. I'm going to wrap it up. Yeah. Thank you.